This is Side 2, session number 43, recorded on June 11th, 2007. And Scott's going to finish his idea, commentary on Randy Copang's Adducation collection on Xenocrony.com.
Right. So I don't remember which image I left off on, but I was just looking at it. There's one from 1925 here called Winning Nature's Secrets. It's a Bell telephone ad. 1943, Men Who Planned Beyond Tomorrow, and it's got this all this science fiction-y space age imagery. 1945, Men Without Machines, which accompanies an article in 1945 in Forbes magazine, The Automated Factory, where the factory is totally automated. There's no human beings running the factory. 1945, they've got images of robots doing the works of human beings in Life magazine. 1952, Robots Colonizing Space, Time magazine. 1960, Man Remade to Live in Space. And all of these images, to me, look like they represent LaRouche's philosophy of pushing technology forwards and putting that first. It's interesting. When was the Stanley Kubrick 2001 movie?
1968.
Yeah, by 1968, we get derailed with this image of HAL, which is telling us that, you know, technology is running amok, and it's
sinister,
yeah. And but we didn't have that image up until, well, at least probably up until 1960. We probably were on schedule with the way things, the way LaRouche wanted to see things go.
Well, if it looks science fictiony, LaRouche considered science fiction a British intelligence operation. He wasn't impressed with H.G. Wells. Any of those guys that come after him, Ray Bradbury or whatever, or maybe even Arthur Clarke, who did 2001.
I just said that, well, one of them looks science fiction-y, but these other ones are not. I mean, they're showing the evolution of technology, where it's heading, and it actually never got there, because we never ended up with hermetically sealed factories where human beings need not enter. That's probably was a result of labor unions and people who were afraid that, human beings would be displaced and they wouldn't have jobs, and they probably stopped this technology from emerging, I imagine.
Remember, LaRouche says that the oligarchs, the gods of Olympus, stopped this technology emerging.
Right.
But LaRouche had a bee in his bonnet about MIT and Marvin Minsky and the guys who created the idea of artificial intelligence and even this idea of these robots taking over. LaRouche didn't agree with that projection of what technology was bringing. LaRouche saw people having more time to listen to classical music and to think up new ideas, new technologies.
Right, because your machines would be doing your work for you.
He didn't see that. He said that humans would have to keep doing work to make better machines.
Right.
They'd still be thinking. They may not be doing that particular work in those factories, but the humans would... He didn't mean we'd be sitting around lollygagging and listening to music, classical music. He said we would have to keep thinking and making better technology because we would be creating more people on the planet. Population would be growing, getting denser, and we needed technological efficiency to support all that. So people would have to listen to great art like Beethoven, Mozart, and classical music to be stimulated with higher conceptions that are embedded in the music.
Well, how did that differ from Bucky Fuller's idea of the world that works for everyone using, you know, technology to liberate man from the drudgery of, the kind of labor that requires muscle and sweat?
Well, LaRouche says that, and he considered Bucky Fuller an agent of British intelligence. He, in the interview Bob Marshall did with him back in 1989, he gets LaRouche talking about Bucky Fuller, and LaRouche says, you know, Bucky Fuller's an interesting guy, but I know in other places he writes, or his associates write, that Bucky Fuller was an intelligence agent, because the utopian idea that's associated with Bucky Fuller is contrary to what LaRouche's view of the future would be. Yes, technology get better, there'd be less kind of drudgery and everybody would be fed, but we would still have to keep working.
Yeah.
And thinking.
Well, he imagines this extreme population density. I mean, how can you actually legislate that everybody, you know, is going to be working? You know, when you have more and more people, you have people are random. You have more and more random possibilities of people breaking out of their own factions or rebelling against the system or not wanting to do things his way or what have you. I mean, people are not...
Well, that's where Luce believes in the power of ideas. If you have the correct education system, the Platonic retracing of all the great scientific experiments and listening to great art and poetry, then you would have a smarter population.
Mm-hmm.
So this may be why people call LaRouche an idealist. He's
yeah.
a utopian.
Well, sometimes it's the smartest people who create the greatest dissent turn into the greatest criminal minds or, you know, I mean, intelligence
doesn't... That's the archetype of Lucifer. Wasn't he the greatest angel?
Yeah. Yeah.
The most beautiful or something? Most intelligent?
Right.
Yeah, that's an archetype.
Yeah.
So, I'm sure LaRouche will explain that situation in the next quote.
Okay.
It's another long one. It's from, let's see, looking at my index at the back. This is written in 1991, an article for the Executive Intelligence Review, Volume 18, Number 22, June 7th, 1991, called The Science of Christian Economy. So, and this is page 37.
Okay. Now, re-examine the same historical connection from the vantage point of our earlier discussion of curvatures of physical space-time. Let us recognize thus that the approximate simultaneity of the collapse of the Anglo-American and Muscovite economic systems shows the convergence of effects of the two systems sharing in common certain among the most flawed axiomatic assumptions implicit in each.
Yeah, Muscovite means Moscow. The Soviet Union was collapsing at that point. Berlin Wall had gone down two years before this, when he's writing this.
Right. The history of European civilization, including the post-1492 Americas, is essentially, as Schiller portrays this, the struggle of republicanism, such as Solon's reform in Athens, against the barbaric heritage of ancient Mesopotamia, usury-ridden oligarchism. British philosophical liberalism, the roots of Hobbes, Locke, Hume, Bentham, Mills, and Smith's, quote, moral philosophy, and of 18th century British Haileybury, that's in brackets, political economy, is in all essential features of the utopian ethical dogma, not chiefly upon pagan imperial Rome, but also upon the ancient pantheistic Delphic cult of Gaia, Python, Dionysus, and Apollo. The principal forerunners of Delphic oligarchism in ancient Greek is the so-called, quote, Babylonian model of ancient Mesopotamian and Canaan. To deduce the relevant common axioms implicit in the collapses of the British and communist political economies, it is perhaps sufficient to compare British and communist dogmas of national and supranational economic practice with the following reference points in ancient and Renaissance history. We begin with the succession of usury-caused collapses of the ancient Mesopotamian, quote,
bow tenure
system of agriculture. We include reference to the circumstances of Solon's anti-usury reforms in Athens. We examine the crucial related issues associated successively with the Flammarion and Gracchi reforms of pre-imperial Rome. We include the process of collapse inhering in the axiomatic features of the pagan imperial Rome of Augustus, Tiberius, Nero, and
Diocletian.
We examine the reasons for the upsurge of economic power generated by the Golden Renaissance and view this with a reflection upon the great enterprises set into motion by Charlemagne earlier. Two opposing features of these cases are emphasized: the role of usury and the issue of increase of per capita productive powers of labor, scientific and technological progress. The forms in which usury's systematic taking of unearned income, in brackets, i.e., quote, theft, occurs may be reduced to three general classifications. First,
the forms in which usury's systematic taking of unearned income, i.e., theft, occurs, the forms in which these occur may be reduced to three general subclassifications.
First, there is simple usury, and that's italicized, payment taken on account of debt, whether the original principal amount of that nominal debt may have been created in payment of money or real value advanced, or simply imposed upon the debtor either by fiat or kindred means. Second, there's the role of monopolies, in brackets, e.g. the International Grain Cartel, in exacting usuriously unearned income from both producers and consumers of some essential commodity. Third, there are the sundry guises of, and this is italicized, ground rent usury. We include among these the evolution of the modern British model of central banking and related forms of public indebtedness, from roots in ancient, in brackets, example, Mesopotamian tax farming. We counterpose, this is italicized, earned profit of physically productive enterprise to the merely nominal, quote, earned profit and interest are italicized, of usurious activities. We explain the necessity and functional basis for this distinction.
So he's laying out what he's going to do in this long article.
Now, he was like an economist before he even started getting into philosophizing about science and everything else, right?
Well, he started off in the 50s as a management consultant.
Uh-huh.
And he claims he had some intellectual eurekas and breakthroughs back then, and then he searched for a way to implement it. And so he...
But it's his sense of economy that drives his sense of science and everything else, isn't it? Kind of.
Yes, he says he's a political economist.
Yeah.
And he's an encyclopedic, comprehensive political economist, he says, because he says creating intelligent people is part of political economy. So you must know science and art and technological developments. It's all intertwined, seamless web. So he's a political economist who makes sure classical musicians perform for her students.
Right.
You know, and your regular political economist in a university doesn't do that.
Yeah.
And runs for office at the same time.
Right.
And gets other people to run for office. So, yeah, he expanded the notion of political economy. And he said that the American system was a suppressed, valuable political economy that George Washington and his associates developed out of the influence of Leibniz. And then there was a whole thread of these guys leading into Lincoln's administration. And then by the 20th century, that American system of political economy was suppressed, and we've had a British intelligence liberal thread that comes out of the people. Did you list those people? And, yeah, Hobbes, Locke, Hume, Bentham, Mills, and Adam Smith.
Right.
They're the Aristotelian erroneous political economists.
Right. And, of course, you know, these guys, what time period are we talking about here, Hobbes, Locke, Hume?
Hobbes is 1650.
Uh-huh.
So after Francis Bacon, who was another bad guy, according to LaRouche.
Yeah.
He was the secretary of Francis
right.
Bacon.
Yeah. Yeah, and then, and up through Adam Smith, he's 18?
No, he's 1760.
17, yeah. So this is, you know, prime typographic man, visual space, printing press man.
Yeah.
And, of course, LaRouche venerating the world of the perfect ideals of Plato. These ideas, I don't know if he would think of it this way, but it appears that his ideas are a balance of alphabet and you know, left and right hemispheres, whereas when we get into this period of Hobbes through
Smith,
we're sort of maybe, you know, the weight is really far to the right and, you know, right hemispheric, typographic, and maybe...
Not right, left hemisphere.
Left, right, exactly. So, but what I'm trying to say is that, you know, from the McLuhan point of view, it's this heavy emphasis on typography, which is not mutating, but distorting, you know, the ideals, Plato's ideals or something.
Yeah, you say LaRouche combines two things, right and left hemisphere. Well, he combines the literate and the oral.
Mm-hmm. You're right. And,
but he's against the pagan version of oral culture, what he calls the pantheistic Delphi cults.
Right. Between 1600 and 1765, or whatever period we're talking about here, visual space maybe begins to drown out this literate oral bias.
Oh, yeah. The last of the literate oral bias, or literate oral balance, McLuhan says, is in the Renaissance time of Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm. Does LaRouche like Shakespeare?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas McLuhan is, not that McLuhan liked or disliked, but he's not... enamored by Shakespeare completely.
Really?
Yeah, he likes Ben Jonson. I mean, he uses Shakespeare in his writings and you know, gives him his due honors, but he's not a... he analyzes Shakespeare, and it's interesting how he talks about Ben Jonson and some of the other playwrights.
Mm-hmm.
And he explains that Shakespeare was retrieved 200 years after Shakespeare lived by the early romantics, like Wordsworth and whoever else was around his time. This would be late 1700s, early 1800s, because Shakespeare represented the spontaneous, untaught genius to the romantics. And they were getting, the romantics were getting sick of the beginnings of industrialism. And you could say the loss of the literate oral culture, because it was moving into... slave cities, coal-polluted cities, the beginning of industrialism, taking the people off the land and putting them in ghettos in London and that,
mm-hmm.
Manchester, and the new industrial cities.
Right.
This shocked the Romantic poets and philosophers, and so they advocated a return to the values of the noble savage or the picturesque, and back to nature,
mm-hmm.
kind of ideals. And Shakespeare wasn't that prominent for 200 years, apparently, but he was seen as a spontaneous, untaught guy. And so McLuhan talks about the ground of why Shakespeare was retrieved.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily saying he likes him. He's explaining...
the ground being what?
The Romantic movement.
Which is, what's the ground for the Romantic movement?
The Industrial Revolution.
Okay, kinetic. Well, we're beefing up kinetic space, moving towards
visual kinetic space.
Yeah, yeah.
Now these phases are irrelevant to LaRouche.
Mm-hmm.
You either doing usury or not doing usury.
Right.
And usury is the big evil for Babylon.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. So that's what he's saying here. He's laying out the history of the bad guys, the usury-based oligarchical empires over the last 2,000 years. And he doesn't, in this section, develop the Platonic counter to the usurious societies, but that will come in the essay, but I didn't include that part.
Right. Yeah, when Wilbur divides his, like we were talking about the big three, I, you, and we, then he divides we into two categories, moral and or social and cultural. And
what are the two categories?
Social and cultural.
Yeah.
And I think social would probably be the what he refers to as the we, he refers to as being the moral. And that seems to be where LaRouche is hanging out, in the moral, in the realm of the moral.
No, you were talking about social and cultural, no moral, so clarify that.
Well, I think social behavior would be have to do with sort of moral behavior. And then you have the culture, which is going to massage the we. And so, I'm just thinking in Wilbur's chart, you probably have a LaRouche in the moral quadrant and McLuhan in the cultural quadrant.
Yeah. Wilbur would do that.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Anyway, but it sounds like LaRouche is it's just becoming more clear to me that LaRouche is moral. That's the foundation of his ethic. He's moral. Whereas McLuhan wasn't looking at morals, he was looking at, the way that culture massages us.
Well, interesting point about McLuhan. He says that it is a Roman Catholic principle that if you judge somebody, you're engaging in sin.
Uh-huh.
Now, religion is seen as a judgment process or philosophy or attitude, so many people think Christians judge. But it's interesting that McLuhan says the Roman Catholic teaches that you shouldn't judge. Now, we hear a lot of judgment supposedly coming out of the church, the Roman Catholic Church, so it's interesting McLuhan emphasizes that, because McLuhan uses that principle to prop up his idea that to analyze what's going on, you don't bring in your value judgments first. You look at what's going on in its own terms without value judgments, and then you can then related to whatever values, ethics that your society claims to uphold.
Uh-huh.
So McLuhan puts off, withholds judgment, value judgment, until people understand the dynamics of what's happening to their sense lives.
Right.
Now, so he is moral, but it's a secondary aspect of his process of cultural analysis and criticism.
Right. Whereas I would say it's a primary with LaRouche.
Oh, with LaRouche it's primary, yeah. But it's not based on religion, or what we consider religion. It's based on whether your society is economically healthy or not,
mm-hmm.
whether it engages in usury or not. That's moral behavior.
Yeah.
So LaRouche would criticize North Americans, British people, as separating their ethical life from their economic life.
Right.
McLuhan would call that a divided schizophrenic person. So LaRouche is for a holistic person, and that person must recognize that moral reality is based on economic, technological potential.
Right.
And the potential for population density.
Right.
So in this quote, he runs through the evil strain, the Aristotelian anti-Platonic strain of immoral, usury-ridden oligarchism, which is the enemy of republicanism.
Right, which probably we could say is, if the human being is, egocentric, is in the infantile and child stage, and eventually grows out of that, then LaRouche's biases is that, that human beings actually don't grow out of that stage. They never really mature. past
he's
the realm.
Biased, he's what's that mean? He's against that?
No, that he's saying that, because remember earlier when we were talking, when we were going into his views on like psychoanalysis and stuff, he was talking about how, you know, when he was talking, when he was critiquing humans as being sort of infantile human and not really growing out of that stage, with being stuck in like the mother-centered stage or what have you. So, you know,
he's biased. He's wait, how are you using the word bias there?
Well, let me retract that word. By the way, I'm not not thinking too clearly tonight because I'm really tired, but I'm doing the best I can. But okay. Let me just say that
his preference is.
Yeah, his preference. Well, the egocentric man is the one who's going to have a division between, you know, his cultural morals and his private business. He's going to be the one who's going to, you know, he's going to be actually taking care of his own needs and not really taking care of the needs of the culture because he's egocentric. If he evolves to a higher stage where he becomes ethnocentric, then he wants to take care of his tribe's needs as well as his own. And if he evolves to a stage beyond that, then he thinks in terms of humanity's collective welfare, and he wants to put that above, you know, even his own private personal needs. And so I think, you know, LaRouche is saying that the way that human beings are educated, they're crippled and they never really grow out of their infancy or their egocentric perspective in the world.
Yeah. And that's what his agenda is. Or his view, his hope, his ideal, his foundation.
Yeah. So it might, we might be able to then conclude that he feels that the oligarchy, who wants to act like Big Brother or the parent, wants to keep, you know, the human population at large in an infantile state of consciousness because it's easier to control them.
Yeah. That's true. So let me reread with that in mind what we have just done, the quote.
Okay.
And again, this is from something LaRouche is writing as the Soviet Union is collapsing. This is published in 1991, June 7, in the Executive Intelligence Review, his organization's magazine, very expensive magazine. And it's called The Science of Christian Economy. So this is Christian economy is republicanism. And the science of it is based on not supporting usury-ridden oligarchism. So as a political economist and a scientist, he brings in ethics and values and preferences for a style of economy.
Mm-hmm.
That's political economy, that's culture, that's ethics, that's science, that's art. All of it is interchangeable. It's all from the same general principles of the higher hypothesis. And then the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis, basically going higher, which is the Plato motif, pointing up, whereas Aristotle looks at the sensory life and doubles around in the mud of senses.
Plato never talked about the hypothesis of the higher hypothesis. I mean, when did that idea formally come into being?
Oh, I assumed he did.
Oh, maybe he did. I certainly haven't read all of Plato, but I've never heard that attributed to him.
Well, no, it's Platonic. It's just that maybe the British intelligence controlled translations of Plato and texts, which LaRouche finds disgusting, don't emphasize those concepts.
Oh.
Certainly, yeah, from a general education and knowledge of Plato that educated people might have, LaRouche highlights aspects that they never heard of or is not emphasized generally in regular education. So that's LaRouche's point. He's unique. He's retrieving the real tradition.
Yeah.
So yeah, you wouldn't even think you were reading Plato when you're reading his stuff.
Right.
Okay, so he says, and this is on that, in that issue of Executive Intelligence Review, this is page 37. So, now, these ideas he's repeating in 91. He said this stuff in the 70s and 80s, the articles we quoted, right?
Right.
So, it's just he brings in different aspects of cultural history in laying down his repeated point that he's always emphasizing.
So there's an underlying pattern that remains constant as the details change.
Yeah. He says, now, re-examine the same historical connection. So before this, that's not in the book, he's talking about something, and talking about the history of something, and now he's going to bring in this history of economy. So he says, now, re-examine the same historical connection from the vantage point of our earlier discussion of curvatures of physical space-time. So here he is talking about the oligarchs, but he's relating it to Einstein and Kepler and Leibniz, curvatures of physical space-time.
He wasn't a fan of Einstein, was he?
He says Einstein, you know, started off pretty good, but got waylaid in the 30s and 40s.
Okay, so, but he believes in Einstein's general theory of relativity and the curvature of space creating gravity.
Oh, yeah, but he would say that Einstein was a genius because he got his theories from Riemann, and Riemann is a big hero of LaRouche. R-I-E-M-A-N-N, Riemann or Riemann. And Einstein developed and was working out of the progress that Riemann was making back in the 1850s.
Mm-hmm.
So LaRouche sees Einstein tapping into the Platonic gang and therefore making breakthroughs. Mm-hmm. Breakthroughs are inevitable if you're doing Plato correctly. Okay, so this section we're reading. Now, re-examine the same historical connection from the vantage point of our earlier discussion of curvatures of physical space-time. Let us recognize thus that the approximate simultaneity of the collapse of the Anglo-American and Muscovite economic systems shows the convergence of effects of the two systems sharing in common certain among the most flawed axiomatic assumptions implicit in each. Now, he's saying in 1991 that the West has collapsed too, not just the Soviet Union. The global oligarchic collapse, because they both were working with the same political economic axiomatic assumptions, which were erroneous, because they didn't deal with the Platonic view of the curvature of physical space-time. Now imagine an economist bringing in Einstein, but this is the point. All the people I feature in the book are encyclopedic and range across all the disciplines and create a new, we'll say, semi-synthesis, an ongoing living synthesis,
mm-hmm.
not a rigid system of philosophical synthesizing. Speaking of McLuhan, Croker, Thompson, and LaRouche. So LaRouche says, the history of European civilization, including the post-1492 Americas, is essentially, as Schiller portrays this, and that would be about 1800, the struggle of republicanism, such as Solon's reforms in Athens, that's before Plato, against the barbaric heritage of ancient Mesopotamia, usury-ridden oligarchism. Let me read that again. The history of European civilization, including the post-1492 Americas, is essentially, as Schiller portrays this, the struggle of republicanism, such as Solon's reforms in Athens, against the barbaric heritage of ancient Mesopotamia, usury-ridden oligarchism. The bad guys, I'm saying that. Next sentence. British philosophical liberalism. These are the bad guys. The root of Hobbes, Locke, Hume, Bentham, Mills, and Smith's, quote, moral philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Bruce doesn't think they're moral. And of 18th century British Haileybury, must have been an economist, political economy, is in all essential features a utopian, pantheistic, ethical dogma, modeled chiefly upon pagan imperial Rome, but also upon the ancient pantheistic Delphic cult of Gaia, Python, Dionysus, and Apollo. The principal forerunners of Delphic oligarchism in ancient Greece is the so-called Babylonian model of ancient Mesopotamian Canaan. So you've got this thousands of years of oligarchic written tradition, starting in Babylonia and Mesopotamia, moving through fallen parts of Greece, Rome, medieval societies, and then the British Empire.
See, now then that brings into question my McLuhan-esque theory that Hobbes, Locke, Hume, and Smith rise to prominence because the typographic typographic matrix is evoking that. But if you had these guys running around in all these ancient cultures as well, then does that...
LaRouche does not think in sensory or historical phases like McLuhan does.
Right, but I'm saying I'm bringing into question my McLuhan-esque theory that Hobbes, Locke, and Smith are evoked because of the typographic matrix. Because if they were being evoked in the past, well, there wasn't a typographic matrix in Babylonia or.
No, they did exist. So, yeah, see, LaRouche doesn't agree with McLuhan.
Yeah, but I'm wondering if I even agree with McLuhan. I mean, if they didn't, if these strains of thinking and culture and power among the oligarchs had prominence in different periods, then I don't know if I can say, well, it was evoked by the typographic environment at all.
Well, the concepts that come out of the different phases, McLuhan would say, is determined by the media mix.
Mm-hmm.
So the complexity of economic thinking that Locke, Hume, and Bentham, I mean, Locke brings in the idea of the supreme value of private property. People didn't have private property in the medieval period.
Mm-hmm.
Private property comes in with
Did they have it in the Babylonian or the Delphic Imperial Roman period? Did they have private code? But I guess they did, because they had slaves.
So yeah, they had kings and a hierarchic system, but it depends on the semantics.
There must have been, if my McLuhan idea about the typographic environment evoking Locke, Hobbes, and Smith is correct, then there must have been some kind of environmental mix, which that was a retrieval of, that was similar in the time of the Delphic cults and the Babylonian and Sumerian periods, where the same kind of economic mentality was rising, was being evoked. There must be something going on in the cultural mix at that time that was analogous to what was happening in typographic man.
Well, they didn't even have printing press.
Right.
People didn't even read. So McLuhan makes a big deal out of the conditioning aspect of these media environments.
Mm-hmm.
The non-print, pre-typographical medieval period, or going back to early manuscript period of Greece and Rome. These were different cultures, totally, completely,
mm-hmm.
having different textures and cultural sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
But McLuhan would say that the printing press retrieved the dreams of Rome and antiquity for the British
mm-hmm.
at the time of Francis Bacon in the 1600s, and therefore the dream of creating a new world empire,
right,
like Rome. But it was
It must have been retrieving an earlier cultural mix, even though it wasn't a typographic mix. There must have been something going on that was creating a sensory mix.
Yeah, it was visual space, because the Romans had papyrus. They did not have the printing press, but they did have an early version of visual space.
Yeah.
So visual space, approximate cultures of 2,000 years before the British Empire started to grow in the 1600s, 1700s, were images that the British Empire, under the impact of print, used those images to guide themselves and moved into a new environment that was completely different.
Right.
That's what McLuhan said. But LaRouche is saying that the issue of ethics and economy and the development people, that idea rides above any sensory determinants. And McLuhan is using sensory determinants of the media environments to distinguish them.
Yeah. But the thing is that if there was a similar sensory determinant during classical Greek,
they had the phonetic alphabet.
Yeah, papyrus is not that different from sheepskin or whatever they were using in the manuscript culture during the, you know, Dark Ages. I mean, they were still using, it was still, you know, script.
Yes, so, but nobody read it. Only the monks and the elites read it.
Oh.
Remember, it wasn't portable.
Oh.
Typographic books are portable, and anybody can read them. That's a totally different situation than the visual culture of medieval society or before.
Well, was the average citizen literate in classical Greek?
No.
Yeah, so I don't know. I'm having a hard time figuring out. They were both using script, and they were both.
The Greeks weren't using script. Script was the content of an environmental, uniform, repeatable commodity called the printed book. It was the first assembly line.
Right, but I'm just trying to figure out why there's a resonance between classical Greek and typographic man during the printing press visual space era.
McLuhan's tetrad says you bring in new environment, it'll retrieve something long forgotten that has a resonance with it. And the printing press did not retrieve Asian culture or Inca culture. It retrieved as an archetype that was brought back as an image, not that they lived like the Greeks, but they used it as an image or an ideal or an archetypal nostalgia. Because the Greek society was based on the phonetic alphabet.
Yeah, but classical Greek culture so highly visual biased on the phonetic alphabet when the phonetic alphabet was running all the way through the Middle and Dark Ages, just like it was in the Greek times, and it wasn't typographic, it was script all the way through.
Right, now listen to this. So McLuhan said the medieval culture and the Greek culture were balanced because they had not an extreme visual dominance. It was in harmony with the oral and the other senses. But it's when you brought in the printing press that pushed visual space into huge might is right dominant sensory bias.
Mm-hmm.
It became the almighty sensory milieu. And so the printing press extended visual space way beyond the balanced interplay of the oral and the visual and the kinetic and medieval and Greek culture.
Right.
It was puny visual space before the printing press. And McLuhan sometimes would say that the printing press almost created a fall, a huge, big problem for human culture.
Sure. Yeah.
Because it was so extreme.
Yeah. But for a moment, let's take the printing press out of the equation and just look at classical Greek up through, the 1400s before the printing press. That was script culture from classical Greek all the way through the 1400s.
Well, they lost a bit with the Dark Ages, at least in Europe, not in Constantinople and what we call Istanbul today.
Yeah, classical Greek was moving rapidly in the direction of the development of science and technology, and then the Christian culture reverted back to mythology.
Greece and Rome were not the same. Greece did not have the roads and paper routes.
Uh-huh.
Mm. So Rome is really the visual culture that's closest to what the printing press is going to intensify.
Right. But in the meantime, we move into the Dark Ages, and Rome reverses its momentum towards the movement of science and technology, becomes dominated by Christian mythic symbolic imagery, and science goes out the window, but the medium of literature is still the same. It's the phonetic alphabet script.
So it's a religious version of visual space.
Right, but if visual space evokes science and technology, how does it fall into the Dark Age? How do we slump into the Dark Ages?
Well, the monks, they created monasteries, and they preserved visual space, but it was not dominant in the Dark Ages. Did not have the light of the page.
Yeah.
It was dark. So they preserved it, and it wasn't until about 1100 A.D. that society got back on its feet in Europe and was able to develop universities. I think the first one was in Bologna, Italy, about 1000 A.D.
Right.
And then people started to copy manuscripts, and they got paper from China or papyrus. And so that rebuilt visual space, and you had the manuscript culture starting to explore science and retrieving science, and that was the period of alchemy.
Yeah.
And Roger Bacon and people like that in And then you have Thomas Aquinas.
Well, that's pseudoscience. It's science.
I don't know. They thought they were doing science, but it was manuscript science.
But they were basing their science largely in mythology and not in empirical observation.
No, that comes in with the printing press.
Right.
Yeah. There might have been a few guys, say, 100 years before Bacon and Descartes, who were thinking that way.
Yeah.
Slightly, but it didn't get going until the printing press.
Right.
Then you had speeded up information access. And then, McLuhan says, the fact that the book is a repeatable commodity, then it affected the conceptual idea of science, changed it from the medieval idea of science to the notion that an experiment was bona fide if it could be repeated like a book is repeated.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, and that's the almost satirical point of McLuhan, is that the idea of science being based on repeatable experiments is just an idea evoked by the environmental effect and fact of the printed book is repeatable and uniform.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's why in the 20th century you get into Heisenberg and these guys bringing quantum mechanics, and they do thought experiments, and they do a different kind of notion of what's a valid experiment. At least they start imagining something different.
Yeah.
Because they start disproving or finding the fallacy in the repeatable experiment. Because in the 20th century, in the electric age, which evokes another kind of science. So the image of science changes through the phases.
Right. But
so that the Euclidean theorems that were done at the time of, a little later than Plato and Aristotle, but that early geometry, they thought they were making amazing insights.
Right.
And it's puny. It's what a kid learns in grade 4 now or something.
Right. But I still don't understand how in Rome you have